and welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie Lesher, and I'll be joined very soon by our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome our listening audience back into another edition of A Mindful Emergence. And at this time, I'd like to welcome into the program our guest, who is Ricky Bird, who is calling all the way from New York City. And we're really excited to have Ricky as a guest. Ricky is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we'll talk more about that. But he's also the founder of Clean Getaway, a nonprofit which is bringing awareness, education, prevention, and addiction resources to those suffering from drug and alcohol addiction through the healing power of music. So welcome to the program, Ricky. Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great, and I so much appreciate you chiming in with us this week. I know you're getting over a cold, so you got a little bit of a cough going on. But,
yeah, it's a little annoying. I'm going to do my best. I actually had it. I had the flu, like most people in the country right now, 3 weeks ago, and I just have like the lingering hacking cough. Yeah. So we'll try to work around it.
Well, it's not a problem. People understand. They're pretty compassionate.
You sound a little distant. Can you come a little closer?
Yeah, let me move this so you can hear me better. Okay. Can you hear me
there
a little bit better now?
There you go.
Okay, good. All right. So
I'm a little deaf from 40 years of rock and roll.
I know. The Marshall amps, were you using those?
That's funny, yeah. Through my, I think my first amp was a Marshall, and all through the Joan period, I was definitely Marshall, if not a stack, at least a half stack.
I know.
And then all of a sudden, I just, you know, the sound of the Marshalls, after a while, I can't listen to them anymore. I'm just, I use like little baby Fenders now wherever I go.
Well, I know that apparently when Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce used to get into big arguments, it was over Marshall amps, apparently, according to Baker. It was a point of contention.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Cream was unbelievably loud.
Yes, yes.
I saw Cream when they did the reunion show at the Garden here in New York City, but and it's funny because they weren't using Marshalls, but they had these baby teeny Marshalls. Like, Marshall makes these little, you could have it in your house to like kind of just plug your guitar into. They're tiny. I mean, I'm talking tiny, like the size of, I don't know, like 6 inches by six.
Mini Marshalls.
And they had them on their amps as a joke, kind of.
Uh-huh. So this week we're going to talk about your journey through addiction into recovery, talk about Clean Getaway, this amazing nonprofit that you've created, and what you're doing. Give us a little bit of an idea, a little bit more, like what's our focus going to be on for the next almost an hour?
Well, I mean, we could talk a little bit about my rock and roll pedigree, my checkered past, so to speak. And my recovery. I mean, I'm in like 30 years, 6 months of recovery from drugs and alcohol. I got clean September 25th, 1987. And before that, I pretty much had an 18-year run of, you know, death-defying acts of stupidity. And I'm lucky to be here. You know, I the journey of recovery has been amazing. It's been exciting. Certainly not boring. And life on life's terms is, you know, it's pretty cool once you get the hang of it.
Well, when did you start playing music?
Oh, man. I started playing, my hand to God, 9 years old. I grew up in the Bronx. And those days, like, I know a lot of families were like this. I mean, in general, I think there were, back then, a lot of families gathered together for dinner and watched certain TV shows. But every Sunday night, and I know you'll know this, there was a variety show called The Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, yeah.
And we watched it every Sunday night. And, you know, when rock and roll came in from Elvis, if you remember The Sullivan Show, it was a variety show. So he would have, like, the cast of a Broadway show, and he would have, like, you know, Topo Gigio, his little mouse puppet, and he would have, like, you know, like Dean Martin, like all kinds of things. And then all of a sudden, when rock and roll came in, you know, you'd see the Young Rascals, and then the British Invasion came, you saw the Beatles for the first time. And then one night I was watching it in 65, and this band called the Rolling Stones came on.
Mm-hmm.
And I just completely identified with, mainly with Keith. And I love the Beatles. I mean, you know how they used to say, are you a Beatles fan? You know, you have to be in one camp or the other. But the Beatles were spectacular, obviously. But there was something about the Stones that hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw Keith Richards, you know, as I mentioned in my, excuse me, in my Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction speech, I said, he looked like I felt. The girls were screaming, and I was shy, so that looked like a plus.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, which says a lot about addiction and just the way I thought, most importantly was Ed Sullivan looked completely horrified after they finished.
Yeah.
And I just went, yeah, that's for me.
That was the biggest selling point.
And even at 9 years old, I just kind of recognized stuff because, you know, and it all ties into, you know, addiction and why we start and different reasons. I mean, I felt I think I felt a little out of place. I was a shy, quiet kid. You know, I always used to draw. I was just to sit by myself. I loved to read. Only child kind of thing. And I think that I saw them on. I just saw something in them that just made me. I just identified with something. I mean, what could you think when you're nine, right? But there was something there. And Keith, just the way he played the guitar, I just went, whoa, I want to do that. And I literally asked my mom for a guitar that night, and I don't know how long it was after that, but her boss got me a, like, you know, like just a no-name acoustic guitar. And she brought it home one day, and I just started to play, and I had no lessons or anything. I just, you know, everybody is put on earth knowing how to do something special. Now, not everybody gets to it because there's a lot of distractions in life. But we all do something great. That's the key to life, is to find out what that is. And my thing was, like, I could listen to a song on the radio and I would just figure out how to play it. I'm not saying it was great. I was only like 9, 10 years old. But I had this ability to just do that. Just like somebody could maybe flip the hood of a car and you know, fix an engine or take it apart and put it together. Or somebody goes into the kitchen and just have that instinct of how to make a great meal. So that was my thing, and immediately I was always kind of artistic, loved to read, and everybody that I read when I was a kid, every book I read was on. I mean, I read Lenny Bruce's autobiography when I was like 12. And then I started to get into, I love old movies, and I love the 30s and the 40s. I feel like I was there at that point. So everybody that I read was, I love biographies. It's funny because I cannot read like novels. I can't read fiction. There's something about it. I just love reading biographies and autobiographies. So, like, I was reading the Marx Brothers, like Harpo Speaks, when I was a kid. And, you know, I just love seeing what people did with their lives. Other funny thing is, when I look back now and I think of all the people that I was attracted to, whether in comedy, movies, TV, music, almost every single one of them was a drug addict or an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Same with me. I was into Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Billie Holiday, Charlie Parker. Of course, I guess when you're into jazz, a lot of the people, you know, addiction ran so rampant. especially through the African American community. But yeah, I mean, in the rock and roll world, I mean.
But I was attracted to something, like, I didn't feel right, even at a very early age. Like, I didn't feel like center. I was like, kind of felt left of center, shy, maybe a little low self-esteem.
When did you start using?
What's that?
When did you start using?
13.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, I'm learning a lot about this stuff now because for no apparent reason, after 30 years of recovery, I was offered a chance to take classes. So I'm getting certified as a recovery coach and a drug and alcohol counselor.
Right on.
So I'm like halfway through. I'm going 4 days a week, but I'm learning a lot about stuff that I go, like, obviously I know a lot being in recovery for all these years, but I'm learning a lot of clinical stuff and I go, you know, and also learning about the history of tobacco, drugs, and alcohol in this country and how it's just like, it's like we just keep circling in the wagons. It's like every few decades, the same thing comes back. So I think that when I look back, what I'm learning now, and when I think back for before I picked up the first one, I kind of had those addictive tendencies. You know, like I always say, you know, people go, and we'll get into this. You know, I go to a lot of treatment facilities and do music groups, but they always want to know, what was your thing, man? What was your drug of choice, bro? You know, and I'm like, I was addicted to more.
Yep.
And, you know, so whatever it is that made me, you know, I was always chasing that feeling of not feeling. And when I think of myself as a little kid, even before I picked up the first one, I always had to have one more of stuff, you know, like, one more, you know, can I just watch one more show before I go to sleep? One more, just one more, you know, can I have one more cookie? Let me have one more cookie. You know, one pack of baseball cards wasn't enough. I needed three packs of baseball cards. And I notice now, after all this time, that when I don't work a solid recovery program, you know, going to, like, my thing is, like, you know, recovery support groups, my thinking starts changing. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So in other words, let's just hypothetically say, like, I've got a credit card with $5,000 on it. Okay, so that's what I owe. And let's say I'm not working, you know, I'm not going to enough support group meetings, and I see a guitar that I want that's like $6,000. Now, if you're in your right thinking, you would say, you know, I got to pay off the $5,000 first before I get something, indulge myself, right? But it's that thing about instant gratification.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I need this. It's, I always say, like, I don't know what I want, but I want it now. You know, so it's like, I'm like, my brain starts obsessing about the guitar, even though, and of course I have people I talk to, and they say to me, you know, you owe quite a bit on your card. Like, don't you think you should pay some of that off first before you buy something else? And it brings me back down to earth. But my thinking is, I need this now. And if I got it, guaranteed, this is what happens with everything, whether it's a piece of clothing, a piece of musical equipment. I'll play it. It'll be my favorite for like a week or two, and then it'll just, you know, sit in the case with the other guys.
Yeah. I'm going to jump in, Ricky, and just remind our listeners, if they just tuned in, that you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina. And I'm joined this week by Ricky Bird, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and also the founder of Clean Getaway, where he brings awareness and opportunity into recovery through his music. So please continue.
So that's when I started playing guitar. And so now I started when I was 9, and then we moved from the Bronx to Queens. So now I'm like 13, and I'm already playing in bands, right? Like garage bands, playing in literally in somebody's garage, which is where the term came from. Mm. What happens with that is, people bring a six pack over. Now all of a sudden, you know, somebody rolls a joint. You know, and that's quite young, but you know, that's the way it is. And it was also the early 70s, and you just kind of roll with it, right? Now, if there's five people in the band, not everybody has a disease of addiction, right? So for me, when I smoked that first joint, all of those kind of inhibitions, fears, you know, self-doubt kind of just went out the window. I was just like, wow, how long has this been going on, right? And, you know, maybe for the other people, it was more of a social thing. And then people, now you're 15, you're 16, you're 17, you're 18, and most people kind of maybe grow out of it, or they just, you know, you could be 60 now and somebody still smokes a joint or has a drink every once in a while, right? Now, if you have the disease of addiction, which is in my family, my dad, my grandfather, I have an uncle in Nashville, my dad's brother, that's, and my father and my grandfather both died of as a result of alcoholism. My uncle Billy lives in Nashville. He's got almost 39 years clean. So I do have this this kind of hereditary, the markings. So the odds go up that you're going to, it's not a guarantee, and this is stuff I'm learning in class too, it's not a guarantee that you're going to wind up with the same issues, but the odds go up, right?
Yep.
It's like if you have like breast cancer in your family, right? That's why they tell you to go make sure you go for mammograms, because the odds go up. So now we're like 16, 17, 18. At this point, I'm moving on from beer to, you know, Southern Comfort, Jack Daniels. Like everybody else is kind of rolling with it, and you know, maybe occasionally you go out. And now I, because of who I am and the way my brain is wired, like if that feels good, then this will feel even better. And that's the way it works, you know. So out of those five people, maybe four of them, you know, became adults and went into business and, you know, got their cars and this and that. And then there was me, right? And then there was, you know, who just kept using, and it just became more intense because the disease of addiction, as they say, is chronic, progressive, and will lead to death if not treated.
Yeah.
So that was it for me. Now I'm lucky. I mean, the ironic part of it is, you know, I'm playing in all these bands and locally, you know, you're playing church dances and stuff like that. And then I started hanging out in the city. And one of the places I played at 16 years old was a very famous rock and roll club called Max's Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I saw Aerosmith there, like, at the very beginning. It was just a very famous club. Like, everybody from Andy Warhol hung out there, and Bowie would come in. Everybody that, when you played in New York... It actually went through two periods. There was the arts, late 50s, early 60s, that whole period. That was all like kind of the art connoisseur people. And the guy who owned it, he used to like, in lieu of payment, the artist would give him like paintings that years later turned out to be famous paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And he would let them eat there. And then somewhere around the late 60s, early 70s, it turned into this rock and roll, excuse me, it turned into this famous rock and roll hangout, and that's where I used to hang out when I was a kid. With that came bigger drugs, hard liquor, because now I was in the environment of that. So now I'm in the world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'm still only 16 and 17, but I'm already hammering it and taking pills and, you know, anything, whatever it was that somebody had.
And you're playing professionally now. Whoa, we just lost Ricky. So I'm sure he's going to call me back. I'm not sure what happened. He's calling from a landline in New York. Ricky Bird is our guest this week. So suddenly the call ended. This would be a good time maybe to point out, and I may have to answer the phone at any second, that if you enjoyed this show, make sure you tune in with McNair Ezard on Thursdays at 5 o'clock for A Better World, a show that looks at people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, the environment, and spirituality. It's interviews with people who are making a difference. And this is Eddie Lesher every week here on WPVM. I'm joined by guests who share their unique experience in supporting personal and planetary healing and wholeness. Usually Margaret Kirshner is with me. She's taken the night off this week. And so I'm going to see. Here it goes. Hey, Ricky. Let me put you on speaker there. We lost you there.
Yeah, that's technology at its finest.
I know,
right?
It's fine. No problem. So bring me up to date. You were playing professionally at this point when you were 16 and 17?
Well, what does professional mean? That you get paid, right?
Technically,
could be
I guess.
Beer, it could be in a few dollars. That's what professional means. But, yeah, I was playing these clubs that like, the New York Dolls played and Iggy Pop and a couple of write-ups of me as, a 16-year-old guitar player. But then, you know, it really kicked off when I joined the Blackhearts, and then we did the Isle of Rock and Roll record, and we hit the road, so the record comes out, and we're on the road, we're like in an RV, and we're playing, you know, like kind of greasy rock and roll joints around the country.
For people who aren't familiar, that's Joan Jett's band.
Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
Right.
So, it was the Isle of Rock and Roll record. I Love Rock and Roll comes out, 1982, and as we're touring across the country, we keep hearing that the record is being played all over the place, and it's moving up the charts, the record charts in the music business, you know, top 40, whatever. And as it moves up the charts, there's more people at the gigs. But we're in the middle of the hurricane, like we're on the road, so we're just playing. But they keep saying, you know, this is like moving fast, this is going, and all of a sudden it's number one, man. It was number one for 7 weeks.
Wow.
So that period, it was also the 80s. And with the 80s came cocaine.
Yeah.
And that was something I thoroughly thought I enjoyed anyway. so I got involved in that and, you know, toured the world and was rocking and rolling. But if you look back at videos, my whole thing's documented, man. What you got to do is go on YouTube. I was basically about 128 pounds, and I was a rock and roll guy, you know, and I thought I looked good, and, you know, I was just drinking and drugging around the world, and, you know.
You thought you had it made, right?
What's that?
You thought you had it made.
Yeah, you know, and you had money to buy stuff, and people always wanted to turn on, you know, people in the band. And there were a couple of, lots of hangovers, lots of near misses. I almost died in 83. I had a really bad lung collapse. We were actually in Opelika, Alabama. I got into some, I like to call it my Richard Pryor period. People could Google that. It's when he was smoking cocaine, and remember he burnt himself?
Oh, yeah.
He set himself on fire, and then he made it part of his act. But, you know, I was smoking a little bit, and I collapsed my lung. And I was pretty close to a massive heart attack. And that happened on the road. We were in Alabama. So, you know, there's that. And the thing about addiction is everybody's got a different bottom. So mine, I didn't get clean until 87.
And you stayed in the band till 93.
Yep.
Yeah. So what was that like? Well, first of all, I have two questions. The first question is, you know, we have this term, because I'm a person in long-term recovery myself. We have this term called moment of clarity. So
yeah.
I'm curious what your moment of clarity was, because obviously having a collapsed lung wasn't it.
No, and there were other things, too, that you would say, wow, man, you're nuts.
I know. Well, yeah, I know. That's why you made the point the bottom isn't the same for everyone. So what was your moment of clarity? And then what was it like? How was it
being
different?
Clean on the road.
Yeah, being clean on the road, because were you the only one and so on?
Well, if you know anything about Bill Wilson, and if you read his story, his moment of clarity, he had the white light experience that they talk about, where he just looked up and he said, if there's a God up there, you know, show yourself, I think was the quote. Mine wasn't quite as dramatic as that. I just literally, one night, so September 25th, 87. Well, let me go back to August, because this is part of the story. So August, they go to a wedding, right, of a friend's wedding, and they sit us next to, you know, you go to a wedding, they sit people that know each other next to each other. They sit us next to my friend Jill, who we used to use with, and I said to her, I literally said my two favorite words back then, you Holden? and she said, no, I'm going to these meetings, and I'm doing this. And, you know, after that, no, I'm going to meetings, things, I heard like Charlie Brown, like, wah, 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 wah. you know. And then I looked around the room to see who else looked like they might have something. But she planted a seed, man. And that night, September 25th, I remember it like it was yesterday. And thank God it wasn't yesterday. I think went out, you know, the usual clubbing in New York City. I was home, off the road for a couple of weeks. And it wasn't even one of those, like, you know, harsh nights where you just think that this is it. Elizabeth, this is the big one, as Fred Sanford used to say. But I was standing in front of the mirror. It was like 2 in the morning, and my nose was bleeding. My heart's beating out of my chest. I'm drunk. I'm high, you know, and I'm, like, rifling through the medicine cabinet for, like, cold pills to steady my nerves, you know, that last-ditch effort when there's nothing left in the house. Like, there's no NyQuil. Where there's nothing to bring you down.
Yeah.
And I literally just looked in the mirror and I said, wow, dude, you're going to die. And I picked the phone up and I called Jill.
Nice.
And she said, could you make it until 4 o'clock tomorrow? There's a meeting in New York on the Upper East Side. And I said, I think I can. And, you know, I met her at this place. And I raised my hand and I said, I'm Ricky, a drug addict, alcoholic, and probably shed a few tears. And that was the beginning.
Wow.
And thank God, you know, no interruptions, no relapse, 30 years plus. And, you know, I still enjoy my support groups. I don't push it. I don't preach it. It's just how I did it.
Yeah. Well, that's the key. And you figured out how to do recovery. And obviously a big part of that is community, and another big part of that is giving back. And they go together.
Yeah.
They go together, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
And you know what? And you have to change pretty much everything, right?
Yeah, your friends.
People, places, and things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I went straight back on the road, right? And so what I had to do was, and there were, you know, there were a couple of funny moments. Like, I had somebody that was helping me. I was calling. And so this is how it works on the road, right? So if you have a long trip after the gig, then you get right on the bus and you head to the next town and you wake up, you know, it's 6 o'clock in the morning and your road manager gives you the keys, you go up to your room. If it's not a long trip, you stay in town and, you know, then the next day at a normal, or you have a day off the next day or something, and then you travel. I'm sorry, this is so annoying, but I'm doing the best I can.
It's okay, Ricky.
So, like, if we were in town and we stayed the night, right, the way it used to be, you'd go to a club after your show, like the local rock hangout, and, you know, 30 people would come back to your hotel, and you'd all go to the bar in the hotel, and you'd stay in the bar until closing, get hammered, and then somebody would say, party in my room, you know, and then that would go, until it was time to leave to the next town, unfortunately, and that was kind of scary. But, and then the other thing is you'd get on the bus, you know, if you had a long trip, like 700 miles or something, get on the bus, and everybody's doing their own thing, you know, so all the stuff that was there before you stopped is still there, right? And my thing is I literally hid in my bunk, because I was so scared, I hid in my bunk with a 12-step big book that I got in Erie, Pennsylvania when I was on the road at a clubhouse. I think I got it maybe 88, something like that. And I would literally, that's what I would do. I would hide in my bunk. I was afraid to sit with everybody else because everybody was still doing the same thing that I used to do. And I didn't want to be around it. And, you know, for a while, when I got clean, I would still go to the room after the, you know, I'd drink my club soda and then, oh, let's go to my room, somebody would say, and I would sit in the room with people getting high. And then the person I was talking to, you know, was helping me from New York said, you think that's a good idea? And I went, yeah, maybe not. So I would go straight to my room. I'd watch Letterman. And it's interesting because, you know, Paul Schaefer's a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah?
And I said to him, yeah, we've done some gigs again. I said to him, you know, and you know, the Blackhearts, we did Letterman a couple of times, and I did it. I played with Roger Daltrey. We did it also. But I said to Paul, you know, your show was so important to me when I was first getting clean because it gave me something to do after the show, after our show. And also it made me feel like New York a little bit, because I was so lonely, and I felt, because I was clean, you know, I felt not part of the rest of the band, kind of, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I felt kind of like isolated a little bit. It's not uncommon. So the other thing I started to do was, when I would get to a town, I would get in my room and I would call up like the local support group hotline number, and I'm saying, hey man, I'm in town for a day or 2 days. Is there a meeting nearby? And somebody would say, yeah, yeah. And I'd say, I'm staying at so-and-so hotel. And somebody would say, you want us to come get you?
Yeah.
And some stranger would come pick me up, and I would get, that would be my get high for the day, you know, the meeting.
Yeah.
And that's really how you do it. You gotta, you know, if you're done, if you are done, not with any reservations, but done, you will find a way, no matter what your situation, whatever your surroundings are, you will find a way to stay done. If you are running a game on yourself and still want to do some more research, then anything's going to get you high or drunk.
I remember, I'll share a brief story with you. I heard this term called the No Matter What Club, joining the No Matter What Club.
Oh, yeah, man.
And I went,
I got
to,
a t-shirt, bro.
I went to a meeting. I was in early recovery years ago, and this woman showed up. It was an early morning meeting. And she, right after the reading, she shared that she'd gotten a phone call in the middle of the night that her son had been killed. And she said, I knew two things. One is, using wouldn't bring him back. And the second thing is, I had to get to a meeting as soon as I could. And she says, I'll probably go to 3 or 4 meetings today and tomorrow and the next day. And I thought, this woman's son has been killed and she didn't use. And I used to get high just because somebody hurt my feelings. That's what they mean by the No Matter What Club.
Yeah, well, there's a saying that goes along with no matter what, mad, glad, or sad, we don't use.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, and I always tell my story. I always say, man, I was the kind of guy, I had to get high to go out and get bread and milk. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
it was part of my lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, you live to use and use to live. So you got to just unlearn it.
Yeah.
You know, you got to, now am I saying it's easy? No, it's not easy, but it's not impossible. You know, first of all, you have this, if you are like, look, if you're there's different stages of addiction. This is all stuff I'm learning in class. But if you're at that last stage, the crucial stage, where like you have the obsession and the compulsion, that's rough, man. You know, that's rough. But if it doesn't matter how long you've used or what stage you're in. I mean, I've seen the hardest cases get clean.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yep.
And then you see the person that comes in and goes, I got this, and then they wind up relapsing.
Yeah, and some of them don't make it. They don't make it back. Some of them don't make it back when they relapse.
And they don't make it back.
Yeah.
And I tell, when I go to these music groups, and I'll talk about that too, you know, I tell them, the clients there, this is not the time to relapse. So when they say relapse is part of recovery, I like to take that off the table, and I say that's part of addiction. So, like, if you relapse, and you're lucky enough to make it back alive, because what's going on right now with fentanyl and you know, the opioid epidemic and heroin, your next relapse, you know, what do they say? I know I have another run in me. I don't know if I have another recovery.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is not the time to be relapsing.
Yeah.
With that said, if you relapse and you're lucky enough not to die, you come right back and you didn't lose any ground. If you use it, nothing in life is a waste if you use it for education.
Yeah.
So I tell these people, it's like, you know, you sit down, take a piece of paper, write what you did, write what you could have done better or differently that might have kept you away from a relapse. Did you isolate? Did you stop calling the people that you call? Did you stop going to meetings? Did you stop reading the literature? Did you start to get that thing in your head, is, you know, that the king of all pre-relapse, which is, maybe I wasn't so bad.
Yeah, maybe I'm healed.
That's the denial thing. So,
yeah.
So the thing is, if you're lucky enough to make it back, and then people go, and they'll say, well, I didn't want to go back to a meeting, I'm embarrassed, and people are going to make fun of me, and I go, okay, dude, 30 years, I've never seen that happen once. It's like, the worst case scenario is you're going to get over-hugged. You know, it's like, welcome back, have a cup of coffee, sit down, you're going to be fine. So the deal is, if you're done, and for anybody listening, like, as hard as it seems, if you're struggling, if you're caught in that hallway between denial and surrender, there's a light, man. Follow the light, you know? And it's my job. The price I pay for having recovery in a different life is I have to kind of look behind me and see who is caught between that hallway. Now, I don't chase people because I can't get somebody sober. Where if you reach out to me, or if I see you like struggling and I know you want help, I'm there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's the price I pay for being in recovery. It's I have to look behind me and see who's struggling and kind of pull them out of that hallway.
Yeah.
And lead them to the water, you know? You can't make somebody sober. You can only keep yourself sober.
Yeah. Hey, Ricky.
So, with that said,
after you make your next point, let's play a song off your CD.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Why don't we start? I'll tell you, when I do these music groups, and we'll backtrack, I'll tell you how this album came to pass. I always start off with Better Days.
Okay.
So let's start with that. It's the second song on the record.
Okay, and that, you co-wrote that.
Better Days.
Yeah, it says Our Bird and
my pal Richie Supa.
Richie Supa. So we're going to go ahead and play this song. This is an album by Ricky Byrd. And that's B-Y-R-D, by the way.
That's right.
And it's called...
and it's real, man. That's my real name.
Clean Getaway. Clean Getaway. All right, let's give it a listen.
When you wake up in a cold sweat, try to remember what you want to forget. Living your life like Russian roulette, it makes you wonder. When you get high is your only friend, but you know it kills you in the end. You've seen better days, better days. Some downtown in a bottle of wine, it makes you cross another line, where demons take you for a ride, and you just let them. Crash and burn without a single lesson learned. You've seen better days, better days. I can't do it anymore. Can't go through it anymore. When you're in so deep you can't get back, all your dreams just fade. Days. You've seen better days. When you have so many alibis hiding in your bloodshot eyes, you can't see through those cocaine lies. You call that living? When life it tastes bittersweet out there on a dead end street. You've seen better days, better days. I can't do it anymore. Can't go through it anymore. When you're in so deep you can't get back, all your dreams just fade to black. You can't walk away, can't walk away. You've seen better days. You've seen better days. Left a scar. Never thought I'd fall this far. When the
Then we have Ricky Bird, and that's a track called Better Days off the album Clean Getaway. And our guest this week on A Mindful Emergence is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Ricky Bird. And we're going to continue our conversation with Ricky in just a minute. I just want to point out that you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPBM-FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And this program is broadcast live every Monday nights. This is program 111, and it's broadcasting live Monday, February 26, 2018. And in addition to tuning in live Monday nights and then Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m., past programs are archived on our show host page. And you can pick them up by just going to WPBMFM.org, going on the schedule and selecting this program, number 111. And all our shows are made possible by A Mindful Emergence LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. And you can access more information at amindfulemergence.com. So let's return back to Ricky. Ricky, this is an amazing recording that you put together focused on recovery. How did it come together? How did you...
I like to call this record a self-help book with a rock and roll backbeat. And funny, and here's a little sidebar. I was just looking on Facebook and somebody said that the interview is great and they're listening right now. So how do you like that?
Excellent.
Yeah, live radio, baby.
We love it.
So here's the thing. I'll do the Reader's Digest version. Maybe 9 years ago, I started to get asked to do these kind of recovery events, whether it was to raise money for some sort of a nonprofit or maybe just an awareness thing. So I put together like a cool all-star band of sober people. And started doing that, right? And so, like, after the first one, somebody came over to me and said, oh, man, you know, I grew up on your music, and it's so cool that you're in recovery. You know, I've struggled. I'm trying to stop. And a little light went over my head and said, huh, interesting. Maybe I could be some help here and combine rock and roll and recovery. And every time I did one of these shows, I'd get the same remarks afterwards. So I wrote a song with Richie called Broken is a Place. And that is the final song in the record. So I have one song, right? And what I do is... So what happened is I took that song and I kind of put it up on the internet, right? Like, I think I had it on iTunes. I started to get this great reaction from people that are in recovery. And then people that just like good songs. And I said, well, this is interesting. So I wrote a second song. And then all of a sudden I had 5 songs. And then I had 10 songs. So what I did is I went to a treatment facility called Sunrise Detox. I said, what would you think if I came in here with a guitar and did like a recovery music group? Yeah, man, why not? So I came in there, I started playing, and I started getting these amazing reactions from the clients and the staff. And they started to, and I'm very transparent. I say, look, you know, I'm on Facebook. Tell me how you're doing when you get out of here. I started getting these messages from people saying like they have the lyrics up on the refrigerator and this song means a lot to them and they wish they had it to take home. And I started to hear that each time I did one of these music groups. And this went on and on. So I was doing stuff at Sunrise for like 2 years. And every single time people would come over to me and go, man, I need this music. Where do I get it? And I kept procrastinating. And I finally said, I got to do a record, right? So, you know, it's not cheap to do a record. So somebody convinced me to do an online campaign. I did that. I raised the dough. And I went in, did this record. I wasn't in every day, so it took 7 months or something. I had some great players on it. I had, you know, Paul McCartney's old drummer, Steve Holly. I got Derek and the Dominoes keyboard player, Bobby Whitlock. I have some of the Asbury Jukes. You know, I played with Southside for like a year, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. I got his horn section. I got, you know, just great players. And the record came out October 20th, my birthday. Also Mickey Mantle's. We'll talk about that later. And you know, it's been getting an amazing reaction. I mean, if you look up on Amazon, there's some really great reviews, and they're playing it a lot on the radio, mostly right now on Little Steven's Underground Garage, which is XM Sirius. And funny enough, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call every classic rock station in the country and college station and say, look, here's the deal. There's an opioid epidemic happening right now. 5 people an hour every day are dying. I did a record that's a rock and roll recovery record. It talks about, you know, addiction, recovery, hope, possibilities. It's not a goofy record. It's a rock and roll record. I did one cover song on it called Kicks. That was a Paul Revere and the Raiders song, which you probably remember.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the first anti-drug song, rock and roll songs. And why did I do that? Is because I knew it would be hard to get it on the radio because of the subject matter. So I threw one song that was a hit already, and sure enough, that's the song that Little Steven's playing on Underground Garage. It's being played like every 4 hours. And that's good because it leads people to the rest of the record. And, you know, there's all kinds of songs on there. I mean, I didn't keep it solemn. There's some stuff that's like straight to the bone. I don't mince words. But I also did a couple of humorous songs. There's a, when you get ready to play another one, there's a song on there that's like a Chuck Berry kind of tune that I wrote called I Prefer Waking Up to Coming To. And basically, the idea of that came from... I was on the phone, I was going to a community support group, and somebody said, man, you got like 3 decades in, you still go to those places? And I said, yeah, man. And they said, why is that? I said, because I prefer waking up to coming to.
Yeah.
And then my songwriter brain said, okay, well, that's a song title, write that down, baby. And you know, so it's all kinds of good stuff on there, different styles, because it's not really like a Bird solo record, so I could jump around genres. There's a great blues song on there called Clean Getaway, which is the title of the album. And basically what I do is I give the record away. Since October, I've given away probably 600 records now. I give it away at treatment facilities. So when I finish a group, what I say to them is, when you're ready to leave here, when you finish your treatment time, you know, not leave early, you ask your counselor for a copy of the record. So I give them away, and for me to be able to afford to give them away, I'm selling them as anybody else would.
Yeah, how do they get them, Ricky? How do they get them?
What's that?
How can they get them?
Well, the easiest way to go is, if you want to see what I'm doing anyway, cleangetaway.nyc, which is another thing we didn't talk about yet. I started a nonprofit, and the goal of the nonprofit is to bring awareness and prevention, information. We'd like to do it around the country. I would like to, and it's all, the centerpiece will be music. Like this album will be the centerpiece of it. And then we will have a person talk about prevention, and we'll have tables set up with information if somebody needs help, and awareness. We'll talk about that. And the music itself is the awareness part as well. And the deal is, I want to have a tour bus that says "Have Recovery, Will Travel," and go across the country and you know, get all my all-star friends that are in recovery and do these cool events. And you know, whether it's to raise money for like a local nonprofit treatment facility or an aftercare place that's on its heels a little bit, or if it's just to bring the message, that's the plan of Clean Getaway. So it's cleangetaway.nyc. On that website, at the top, there's a link, and you could get my record. You just click on the link, it'll give you different options like iTunes, Amazon, CD Baby. So there you go. It's real simple. So just go to cleangetaway.nyc.
It would be great if the people listening who run treatment centers would go and get copies to give their clients.
Yes. Not only that, bring me to your place, and I'll do a recovery music group.
There you go.
You could just get in touch with me. I'm all over. You can get in touch with me through the website, or I'm on Facebook. I'm really easy to find. I don't hide,
yeah.
And I'm not anonymous. Let's throw that card on the table.
Yeah, exactly. So, Ricky, you know, here's the deal. We got 9 minutes left, and we can play another song. You can talk about Mickey Mantle. Just so you know, what kind of time restraints we have, and where you want to put your focus.
Let's play, I'll tell you what, one of the songs that I play is called Lighthouse. And I explain to the people in the treatment facility, you know what a lighthouse, it guides the ships into port safely. And I say, to my, I tell them, I said, well, if I'm, my lighthouse is if I'm walking down the street, and, you know, there's times even in long time recovery where you feel kind of uncomfortable in your skin, correct?
Absolutely.
You're not doing the work. You kind of feel a little squirrely sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm walking down the street, and I'm a little confused, and, you know, I look, and I see maybe, let's just say, a church, and on the side of the church are steps that go in the basement, and on the doorknob in the basement is like a triangle with, you know, a blue triangle. And I know there's a community support group there, a meeting. That's my lighthouse, baby. So I wrote a song called Lighthouse with Richie, and it's pretty damn good, so that's a good one to play.
All right, here we go.
I was down and so torn up, wasted every day. I followed my own lies till I lost my way. Got an endless list of my regrets. I'm trying to get past. I think I've had enough at last. There's a lighthouse out in the distance, shines to guide me home. When I'm lost, your love lifts me higher. When I can't make it on my own, hide my pain deep inside so no one else could see. I kept playing with fire till it burned a hole in me. And I ran with my reckless ways. I thought I'd never fall till I crashed and lost it all. There's a lighthouse out in the distance, and it shines to guide me. When I'm lost, is a lighthouse, and it shines to guide me home.
Man, that's a great track, Lighthouse, off the album Clean Getaway by Ricky Burt. Love the horns on that. Great horns.
That's the Asbury Juke horns, man. Southside's horns.
Yeah, Southside Johnny.
Southside Johnny, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that is Ricky Burt, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and A Mindful Emergence. We got about a couple minutes left. Ricky, what else do you want to share with our listeners?
Well, let's put the cards on the table. There's an opioid epidemic right now that's out of hand. We're losing a whole generation. If you can help, help. If you got kids, keep your eye on your kids. If you're struggling, get help. There's no kidding. This is not fun and games. Understand something. If you're struggling, we do recover. I'm clean 30 years plus. I was as bad as it gets. 18-year run, man. And here I am. Here I sit, like, you know, an adult. I got a 16-year-old daughter. I'm a great dad, you know. All the perks that come with recovery. There is an answer. There is a solution. I want you to, if you're listening out there and you're struggling and you're scared, reach out for help. This is, you don't want to die from this. And I can tell you that nobody wins with drugs and alcohol. Alcohol maybe lasts a little longer, but the end game of alcoholism is not pretty. If you want to get truthful, liver disease, heart disease, diabetes, wet brain, I mean, on and on and on. A drug addict might be a shorter shelf life, but either way, nobody beats this. There's never been anybody that's beaten this. Of course, there's exceptions to every rule. Keith Richards, we can't explain, but that's a whole other conversation.
He's a freak.
But the point is that if you need help, ask for it. It's out there. This is the best time to be in recovery right now. There's apps on your phone if you need help. There's all kinds of treatment. There's all kinds of stuff going on. There's all kinds of events going on. Back in the day, there was like nothing. And people had to really search out. It's at your fingertips right now.
Yeah.
So that's all I, you know, we do recover. I don't know what else I could say to that. I mean, there is an end game to this. You do not have to die from this disease.
You do not.
And if you want to get this, if you're in recovery, you're going to love this record. If you're struggling, you're going to need this record. And if you love rock and roll, it's a pretty damn good rock and roll record above and beyond everything else. And if you want to get it, you go to cleangetaway.nyc. You could also read about my nonprofit, which we're trying to fund now so we can do some of these events. And right at the top of the front of all the pages, there's a little link to this record. You click on it, it'll take you to a place to buy it. And then what I want you to do is, you know, find me on Facebook or something and tell me if it's affecting you, if you're enjoying it and you're identifying with the lyrics.
Yeah. Ricky, I got to jump in, and thank you so much for spending time with us.
All right, baby. Thanks. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners for joining us on another edition of A Mindful Emergence.